and happy new year, and welcome back to Musings on Sports for 2023. My name is Kelly Elbin, along with my co-host Bob Bupka. Bob, we have a lot to talk about as the new year begins. We have a terrific guest today in Chicago Times, Sun-Times sports columnist Rick Tellender. But unfortunately, we have to begin with the focus that is on DeMar Hamlin. As we record this a little after 1 o'clock Eastern on Tuesday, the 3rd of January, he remains in critical condition at a hospital in Cincinnati after suffering cardiac arrest in the Buffalo Bills game last night in Cincinnati. Bob, it was a very somber evening, to say the least.
Yeah, it's an awful sight to see an ambulance come out onto a football field. You know, the two just don't go together. You think of football and being played for pleasure and entertainment of the fans, and they had to witness an ambulance come out, and you could see that there was something terribly wrong just by the players' reaction. And our prayers and the prayers of our listeners go out to Mr. Hamlin, and I'm sure he's 24 years old, so yeah, he's in pretty good shape, better than most, I would imagine. He is hoping that he's going to pull through this.
Yeah, you know, I think sometimes we lose track that these guys are, and in his case, he's a young guy. As you say, he's 24, and you hope that that he is able to pull through. My gosh, was thinking as we learned a lot about, as much as we could, for what happened last night, those first responders, those ones who are on the field administering to him, more stories obviously will come out later, but my sense is that that they saved his life. And I also want to, you know, in these times, it just seems to me, Bob, as fractured as we are as a country in many ways, we do find the ability to come together at moments like this. And I was really struck. I thought it was very poignant to see fans of both the Bengals and the Bills holding a candlelight vigil, saying prayers at the hospital last night. It was a very, very real moment. There was nothing rehearsed, and no one was upset. I think people in the stands in Cincinnati understood immediately what the gravity of the situation. And then Bob, as you and I were chatting before we came on, this GoFundMe children's toy drive that DeMar Hamlin established 2 years ago, and which had raised just under $3,000 in 2 years, has now raised more than $4 million for toys for kids to go to them during the holidays or, you know, I would think now just about it at any point. But $4 million, people's hearts open up sometimes at the worst of times.
And what a perfect prescription for DeMar when he comes to.
Yeah.
And we're praying that he will. And he's told that $4 million has been raised. That's the best possible medicine he could ever get.
Yeah, no question about it. Lots still to be decided. Lots up in the air as far as will that game ever be rescheduled? I don't think it will be. And how the NFL handles that, how they handle the tiebreakers then going into the playoffs in terms of what seeds certain teams are, and then the schedule of games this week. So sounds like the league has sort of shut things down for a day in a lot of ways. And they've got a lot to work through. But this young man is absolutely the most important in his health. Let's just hope to God that he pulls through. We do have a big college game coming up with Texas Christian University and the University of Georgia coming up on Monday. Bob, unbelievably high-scoring, dramatic, highly entertaining college semifinal games. In the championship game in Arizona on Monday, I don't know if TCU can win. I still think Georgia, they're just so good. But man, I expect, I mean, these the four teams in the semifinals, they scored 179 combined points. If nothing else, I think you're going to see a lot more points scored in the national championship game, which I think Georgia will find a way to pull out.
Well, it's amazing to hear you say that. You don't think TCU is good enough to win. That's only been said about 10 times over the last 10 weeks on every game they played, and somehow, some way, they find a way.
I don't know if Max Duggan will ever be a really good NFL quarterback, but Max Duggan, that red-haired rifle for TCU, is a hell of a college quarterback and so much fun to watch. And Sonny Dykes has done an unbelievable job at TCU.
First year. Sonny's first year. It's amazing.
Isn't it amazing?
Oh, I love it. I love stories like that.
You can turn things around, Bob. If you get the players, which happens now with the transfer portal, it can happen. And if kids, you get the right players, the right talented players, and they believe in your system, and you get a guy like Duggan at quarterback, man, you could pull games out. You can find ways to win. I know that the Big Ten has got to be exasperated with Michigan and Ohio State both losing, but those games were crazy. Martina Navratilova, our hearts go out to her. She's always been a very strong-willed professional as a great tennis player and just as a person. Cancer diagnosis. Sure hope she can successfully fight through this, Bob. I know she will fight through it.
Yes, she said she will fight with all she has, and boy, could she fight. So we're hoping that she finds a way to recovery. One of the outstanding all-time tennis players.
Before we get to Rick Tellender, I want to get your perspective on the start of the PGA Tour season. This is the Century Tournament of Champions out in Hawaii. This is the first what's being called a series of elevated, which basically means more money being added to the overall purse, elevated events on the PGA Tour in 2023. I know Rory McIlroy is not playing. You're allowed, apparently, among the top players to opt out of one of these elevated events, but it's a heck of a strong field and a great way for the PGA Tour, it would seem, to get 2023 off and going.
I think the PGA Tour players have pulled the wool over the eyes of the PGA Tour, because having been to this Tournament of Champions event for many, many years, and of late with Century being the sponsor, and you get to go to Maui, and then you get to walk around that Kapalua golf course, and you get to eat in finest restaurants. The players, if the truth be known, they probably pay to go there. Nevertheless, getting an elevated purse to play there.
Well, it will continue to be a most interesting scenario to watch how the LIV Golf versus PGA Tour dynamic plays out. I know LIV Golf still has yet to release its entire schedule for 2023, but this is things I think are looking better, Bob. If I'm viewing this correctly, things they seem to be looking better for the overall health of the PGA Tour.
And they seem to. And of course, everything's going to be decided when we get to a court of law. Unfortunately, that's going to be the ultimate decision. A big win for Liv, I think, in Fred Ridley of the Masters, saying that if you're eligible to play in the Masters, you can play. They're not going to discriminate against Liv players. Anyway, great field out at Maui. John Rahm, certainly the early favorite. He hits it a mile. This is a big boys' playground, I'll tell you that. You have to hit it far. I'm going to go out on a limb. I'm going to be picking Cam Young. He was last year's Rookie of the Year, but he hits it 9 million miles, and he's going to fall in love with this plantation course.
Bob Bupka picking Cameron Young to get the win to start the PGA Tour season. I like that. Okay, so we're going to hear from Rick Tellender in just a minute. Lots of great stories of Michael Jordan and Mike Ditka. Rick's a tremendous writer. And stories about the inner city playground basketball book that he wrote back a number of years based on his experiences playing in New York City on the playgrounds. And you're going to hear from Rick Tellender of the Chicago Sun-Times right after this from our friends at Bridgestone Sports.
Today, there are smarter phones, smarter cars, smarter everything. So Bridgestone Golf's engineers thought, why not a smarter golf ball? Introducing the new Tour B, with a smart reactive IQ cover that delivers more power off your driver, more control off your wedges. Try Bridgestone's new Tour B with reactive IQ cover. The smarter tour ball.
Welcome back to Musings on Sports. Bob, as we begin a new year, we are delighted to welcome in one of America's great sports writers as our first guest of 2023. He has written for Sports Illustrated, is currently the senior sports columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times, and among the eight books he's authored are his own experiences in the Kansas City Chiefs training camp and playing basketball on city playgrounds in New York. Yet, as far as I'm concerned, Rick Tller might be best known for being the youngest one by far in the pioneering TV show with a bunch of cigar-puffing Chicago sports writers in the 80s and 90s, the pride of Peoria, Illinois. Hey, Rick Tələndir, welcome to Musings on Sports.
Thank you, guys. I'm happy to be the kick it off for 2023.
Yeah, it's going to be a much better year than it was in 2022, we certainly hope. Let me ask you something, Rick. Hearing about you playing basketball on the playgrounds of New York, there was a name that popped into my head, and I at this point, I don't even know if it's fictional or reality, a guy by the name of Helicopter Knowles.
Yeah, Knowings, yeah. Herman the Helicopter Knowings. Yes, he's a real person. I met him that summer at the Rucker Tournament. He was sitting in the stands, and I went up, and I couldn't believe that's who it was. The greatest, one of the greatest nicknames of all time, the Helicopter, and he got it because he could jump so high, as legend has it, and so many of these stories are just wonderful urban legend, that the he faked the guy, or a guy faked him. He jumped up in the air so high, but by the time he came down, they called 3 seconds on the other player. So, and, you know, he'd do things like pick quarters off the top of the backboard, stuff like that. He was actually a very delightful, very quiet, very subdued man, about 6'4", really well built. Had hearing issues. I think he was deaf in one ear, might have had just sort of hearing impaired. Nice guy, and just sitting there, and he was done playing basketball when I saw him, but he was a real person.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. You know, you get these names stuck in your head. That's the first time I've said that name probably in 30 years. So,
hey, Rick, we're going to talk about your career, obviously. But before we start talking about those stories, I wanted to get your perspective on the very sad situation we saw play out last night with DeMar Hamlin of the Buffalo Bills going into cardiac arrest on the field in Cincinnati. So as we record this a little after 1 o'clock Eastern time on Tuesday, January 3rd, DeMar continues to be in critical condition at a hospital in Cincinnati. Hey, Rick, you played the game at a high level collegiately. You've covered a lot of NFL games through the years. Your perspective on a really tough situation.
First off, it was very complex and just gut-wrenching. It's just horrible to see. I'd say the ultimate irony is that the game of football, players try to hit the other players hard as they can. You know, they're rewarded for that. Their teammates high-five them. The coaches love it. And you try to hurt a man as much as you can without hurting him. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a, I don't know, almost like a an oxymoron or whatever, but nobody wants to kill somebody. Nobody wants to see somebody killed, just as in the boxing ring. But these are incredibly violent sports, boxing and football, and indeed MMA. And when I saw that last night, I don't know, man, the hair on your arm stands up. You feel this kind of sickness, and it makes you question a lot of things that you just would like to have in the background, like, well, it's a violent game. Guys get hurt. They get chronic traumatic encephalopathy down the road, CTE, much easier to say, you know, but the game itself, we love. So there's this, always this dynamic. When you see what we saw with DeMar Hamlin And, you know, I mean, all I know is what you guys, what you just said, Kelly, and you hope that he survives. You hope that he's okay. You hope that the game, I don't know if it was caused by the tackle. It was a very rough tackle, which he seemed to take the worst of it.
Yeah.
From T. Higgins, the wide receiver for the Bengals. But you don't know if that had anything to do with it. And one thing, you know, talking about one of the books I did way back, Heaven is a Playground, occasionally, randomly, and tragically, players would die from sudden heart attacks in high school or on playgrounds. I remember talking about it with, you know, some of the people in the book way back then, way back in the mid-70s, and nobody knew why, but it was some kind of heart defect. I don't know if this has anything to do with this sudden cardiac arrest or if this was football-induced, but either way, the whole nation got a chance to pause and I think about it.
You know, Rick, I'm sure you agree with me. When you watch that scene unfold, and unfortunately we've seen it way too many times on a football field, but the amazing tonic that we would always get is as the player is being wheeled off in that stretcher, he puts his thumb up. And to me, that was always a sign that, oh boy, you know, he's going to be all right.
Yes, exactly. That was always, phew, thank God, the guy's, he's going to be okay. Because if you can move your arm, lift your thumb up, even if you're strapped down, which they usually are as a precaution because of a neck injury or a head trauma, it means they're okay. And we saw something this last weekend that was, in its way, almost as tragic and horrific. And that's when quarterback, Foles, Nick Foles was knocked out and on a tackle, and he's actually having a spasm. He's unconscious, and he's shaking uncontrollably. And next to him is the player who tackled him. He's doing a a faux snow angel on the grass. He doesn't even know.
Thibodeau.
He's right next to him. Yeah, Thibodeau. Yes. And I'm thinking, oh my God, was that just horrible? Of course, the player didn't know, but it shows what this game is all about. A great hit might someday be one that kills a player. And that's something that is very troubling.
Well, Rick, as Kelly mentioned, you had great success as a writer, but you really became known nationally as a regular panelist on the syndicated show, The Sports Writers on TV. Remind our listeners what that show was and why it was so significant.
Well, it was in Chicago. Our first show was in December of 1985, and to describe it, it was a cloud of cigar smoke with four sports writers inside of that billowing bonfire of tobacco smoke. And the guys, Bill Gleason, Ben Bentley, and Bill Jouse. Gleason and Jouse were sports writers, longtime sports writers. Gleason for, he'd been with the Sun-Times, the Daily News, then the Southtown, and I think ultimately the South Bend, Indiana Tribune. But Bill Jouse was with the Chicago Tribune, and Ben Bentley was a ring announcer and the head of the something to do with the Park District in Chicago, and he had that great voice, great voice. They're all Chicagoans. They're all about 30 years older than me. I was young calendar, as Bentley used to say. And I used to say, Ben, were you one of those guys where that microphone would come down from the ceiling of this big, legendary fight hall, come all the way down, he'd take on through the smoke, and he'd say, in this corner, in the white trunks. And he said, yes, I was that man, Kellen. So we talked about everything, and we just talked. It was, there's no posing, there's no TV readiness. We just went. Our producer, John Roach, was brilliant in that he said, you guys are the real deals. Just talk about sports that you know. And I was so much younger than those guys. They actually needed somebody who could be available on Mondays. And a lot of the beat writers for the other papers, sometimes Tribune, Daily News, what have you, couldn't. But I was writing for Sports Illustrated, so I was available on Mondays. And I also knew all those guys from, I knew Jouse and Gleason from them coming in the locker room when I was playing at Northwestern. And I love those guys. I loved them. And Gleason always had a cigar in his mouth, even if it wasn't lit. I think he was born with one. A little baby came out with a cigar, you know. Hey, talking out of the side of his mouth. Oh, I love those guys, man. Oh boy.
Oh, it was so much fun. For you, it had to have just been a kick and a half. Even though, and by the way, is that the main reason they invited you, because you were available? I mean, you were significantly younger than those guys.
Yes, I was, and both of those things are true. As John Rhodes, God love him, the producer, he's a young guy. He said, and he's from Madison, Wisconsin, so Chicago. He would come down all the time. He always drove in, and he had a lot of TV work in Chicago. He said, when I was thinking about this show with Gleason, we figured we needed at least one person that didn't have a prostate problem. So, of course, that was them. But I was available, right. And I knew those guys, and they had to approve of it because they weren't going to take somebody they didn't like. And, it was kind of like, we know that kid, that kid, Callender. Yeah, bring him on. So, So that's it. That's the story.
And this, and obviously this predated all of your ESPN, the Kornheiser and Wilbon show, and so much of the round table discussion. But man, what you guys did, to use the term organic, I mean, it was so organic, Rick. It was just like four guys, just almost like in a Cheers bar setting with smoke everywhere.
Yes. And, you know, it's not easy to pull that off. You better like each other, first off, because you're not playing to the cameras. We did not read scripted things. We knew what each segment would be. We talked about it in advance. And you're right. This predated the sports reporters on ESPN with Dick Schaap. I was on that a number of times and loved Dick Schaap. He taught me so much when he was the editor at Sport Magazine. He helped me out immensely when I was just a freelance writer in my early 20s. And also Kornheiser and Wilbon and Mitch Albom, all those guys. We used to do that. We used to sit around at Super Bowls and what have you and just chew the fat. I mean, Kornheiser and Wilbon are just doing what we used to do for free with all of us at a bar somewhere. So the idea of having sports writers talk about what they knew on radio or TV was a novel thing. Because before that you had TV guys and you had radio guys. They had the radio voice, or they were, you know, pretty boys who looked good on TV. We had faces made for radio, as they said. But those guys were way ahead of their times. Gleason, Giles Bentley, and even Joe Mushel, another old guy, a Marine from World War II, the AP sports editor for years in Chicago. They were way ahead of their times. They started on WGN radio in the 1970s. And with that round table, which became the basis for every round table, politics, everything, on and on, whatever, wherever you want to find one, it started with those guys and the sports writers on radio and then sports writers on TV.
Oh, great stuff. Rick Callender, voted 8 times as the Illinois Sports Writer of the Year, is with us on Musings on Sports. Hey, Rick, you mentioned about your days at Northwestern, where you were an all-Big Ten defensive back as a senior, drafted by the Chiefs in the 8th round in 71. Hey, talk for a little bit about the memories that stand out from those days at Northwestern. You had a hell of a teammate in Mike Adamley, who was an All-American fullback, Big Ten MVP in 1970. Those were some pretty proud days for you, I imagine.
Yeah, they were. I was always happy to play football at any level. I was basically a skinny kid, and, you know, everybody has something that they can't stand about themselves. And I always thought that I would be too skinny to play the game. I was a swimmer when I was younger, and if I ever do an autobiography, the title will be Hungry. And I mean, literally, I was hungry my whole life. I never ate enough. I wanted more food. I've had friends say, God, Rick, you know, my mom would have fed you. What was wrong? I said, well, we just didn't have snacks. We didn't have candy bars. We didn't have Coke. We didn't have potato chips. You ate 3 meals a day, and the meals were terrible. And anyway, I was happy to keep playing football at the high school level and then at the collegiate level, and then to get drafted by the Chiefs. I really couldn't believe it. But my teammates at Northwestern, I love those guys. You know, you bond with whoever you're with so much. And my senior year, you know, we were one game from going to the Rose Bowl, which was the only game that a Big Ten team went to back then. There were no other bowl games for anybody except the Rose Bowl, and the champion went. And we were playing Ohio State in Columbus, and we were ahead at halftime, and I won't go into the rest of it, but you know, still painful. But there with the Chiefs, so there I am, this kid from Peoria, you know, via Northwestern, and the Chiefs at that time had 10, would have 10 players and people there, including Hank Stram, the coach, and Lamar Hunt, the owner, in the Hall of Fame, would go to the Hall of Fame, the Pro Football Hall of Fame, and, you know, including the late Lenny Dawson, Buck Buchanan, Willie Lanier, Johnny Robinson, Curly Culp, Emmett Thomas, Bobby Bell. It's like a Mount Rushmore.
Yeah, I was going to say, you can understand why the Chiefs were really good back then.
Yeah, and so they didn't need, you know, little Ricky Callender, but they figured that out, and I figured it out, too. But I have to say, I really, really liked Len Dawson. He was so nice to me, this rookie that had, you know, was just, you know, didn't know what was going on, starstruck, everything else, trying to make the team. He'd let me come into his dorm room. We were all at William Buell College during training camp, and I would just sit on the floor, you know, because it'd be him, he'd be sitting on the bed, maybe lying back, and Gerald Wilson, the punter, would be there. I think they were kind of pals, and Mike Livingston, the third-string quarterback, some other guys maybe, and they would just tell stories. And he had a case of beer, you know, there, a couple of cases stacked up, and just sit there. I think he was smoking cigarettes, and I was like a guy sitting around a campfire listening to, you know, the Indian Braves tell stories to the young, you know, youngins coming up. I'll never forget it. Never, never. And Lenny didn't have to be nice to me, and he was just so timed. I don't know. And so was Jan Stenerud. Oh, there's the other Hall of Famer. Mm-hmm. I would stay out late after practices just so I could catch field goals, and he would kick them from 65 yards. And I'd be at the other end. I'd be just like marveling at this ball. And I talked to him. And he was from Norway, had a great accent. He was a skier, a great skier. And I really bonded with him, too. We just had a great time. And then the defensive backs, Willie Mitchell. I have to tell the story. Willie Mitchell was a great guy, but he was afraid of snakes. And there's a training table at William Jewell, and it was just like a classroom or something. And somebody brought in a rubber snake. He knew this was going to happen. And like threw it at him, whatever, and he jumped out the window. It had a screen on it. It was only on, like, you know, it wasn't that high up. It was under grass, but that's what he did, and he was gone. anyway. I haven't thought about this stuff.
What great memories, huh?
Your lifestyle's making me jealous, Rick. Anyway, you know, you covered a lot of famous sports figures over the years in Chicago, likes of Mike Ditka, Michael Jordan at the top of that list. Is there a story or two that stand out regarding those two legends?
Well, yeah, I can tell you one about Jordan. You know, Jordan was a great trash talker, and I think everybody saw the kind of person he was when he gave his Hall of Fame speech. I mean, he is just, he never forgets anything. He never forgets any slight, nothing whatsoever. No matter how lowly you are, he will not forget it if you try to one-up him. So he was kind of, you know, we were friendly, and he was doing me a favor. We were doing a promotion for the sports writers on TV, and we each had on a mic, you know, and I said, okay, listen to what we're going to do. It was in this gym where the Bulls practice. After practice, nobody was supposed to be there. Everybody's supposed to leave, but the sports writers, the other writers got wind of it, and they all stuck around. So they're catcalling from the sidelines and all. And I'm dribbling the ball. I said, Michael, you know, I'll do this, and then I'm going to dribble around you, and then we're going to cut over here. And I was going to jump off a trampoline and dunk the ball. But anyway, I'm... And he said, nope, you ain't doing that. You are not doing that, because I'd have to jump over the top of him. He's not going to allow it. So anyway, I'm just dribbling the ball, talking, mic'd up, and I'm saying everything I can to, like, trash talk. So, you know, what are you? You're nothing without your buddy Scottie Pippen, who was injured at that time. And where's, you know, where's Looney Tunes? Where's Bugs Bunny? You know, he'd just done whatever that movie was, Space Jam.
Space Jam,
and
yeah,
I'm going on and on. Until I was breathless, and I'm like, and because I was still dribbling the ball, he's just crouched in that position, looking at me. And finally, he just looks at me and he says, "You are bow-legged, aren't you?" this is after like me jabbering for 5 minutes. So that was him. That's the kind of stuff he could do to you, just rip your heart out. Anyway, and with Ditka, I remember my house was right next to Hallis Hall, the field where the Bears practice. It was Lake Forest College in Lake Forest, and that's where they were. They shared this field, if you can imagine, the Super Bowl champs, with a Division III college football team. And anyway, my house was literally on the where the end zone is, and there's some bushes and a few trees. But if I were on the second floor, in the fall when the leaves are off, I could see the whole field. I could look all the way down to Hallis Hall. I could see Michael McCaskey's office. I could see Ditka's office. Anyway, we were doing some remodeling. We had a workman up on the roof on a hot summer day. He was putting in a skylight. We needed light in this bathroom. And he's up there looking at practice, you know, not that far away. Because when he kicked the field goal, it would actually hit our house if they did that. It would hit the roof of our house. So he's up there. And all of a sudden, I'm downstairs. All of a sudden, he comes running down. He's like white as a ghost. This is a workman. And I'm like, dang, what happened? He said, well, I was up on the roof, and I said, hey, Ditka, why'd you trade Duerson? And I said, oh, God. And I said, what'd you say? And he said, hey, you, use your hammer, not your mouth. The guy was terrified. I don't know if he ever went back on the roof until the practice was gone. Ditka was gone. He was so scared. So I do remember those things among many other events with those guys, you know.
Hey, Rick, let me give you one with Jordan. Out at Lake Tahoe, that Celebrity Golf Classic, our executive producer, Janet Self, said, boy, we'd really like to get Michael Jordan. I said, well, you go ask him. So she goes over and asks him, and then he says, where do you want to do it? She said, well, it has to be quiet, so let's go down the cart barn. So she takes him down the cart barn. I get lost getting there, and when I finally get there, he said, I don't want a word of this out to anybody. Michael Jordan had to wait in the cart barn for Bob Boepka.
Well, there you go. That's it. And he probably would have come back and tried to kill you if he found out you did kill anybody. Oh, he was something. I think about him all the time. I actually left Sports Illustrated. One of the reasons I left and became a columnist for the Sun-Times in 1995 was because Sports Illustrated put him on the cover showing him playing baseball, and the headline, infamous headline, said, bag it, Michael. And it said, Michael Jordan embarrasses baseball, and the White Sox embarrassed baseball. And it showed him missing a pitch by about a foot. And this was in 1994 when he had retired first time from basketball and gone off. His father had been murdered. He had left the game. He'd gone off to play in the minor leagues. Actually, was not that bad a baseball player for not having played for, I don't know, 20 years. And he, knowing Michael, I was fearful this would happen. He said, you know, I don't think I'm ever going to talk to Sports Illustrated again. And he didn't. And that was 1994. And there I am. And I'm thinking, I can't live in this city and have this person not talk to me for the rest of my career, the rest of his career. So that was one of the impetuses, for me to become a columnist at the Sun-Times in 1995. And Michael held to it, never has spoken to Sports Illustrated since.
Wow. He's a man of his word, that's for sure.
That's right. So you better watch out, Bob.
I know. He's still looking for me. I tell you, Heaven is a Playground. That's a book you wrote about playing basketball on the city playgrounds in New York City, the legendary playgrounds, where probably more great basketball was played on the playgrounds than in Madison Square Garden.
Yeah, well, in certain ways, it was one and the same. The players, like Tiny Archibald, even Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, then Lou Alcindor, Dr. J, all these guys, Billy Cunningham, these old names from the New York area, they would play playground basketball. You know, it's hard to believe, but that was kind of the roots of the modern NBA was all there. It was taking place in the late 60s and early 70s. And I wanted to see it. I wanted to see it. To me, it was like a kid traveling off to Oz, you know, like Dorothy. It was just something that there were no cameras back then. There were no video cameras. There were no hardly any tape recorders. It was all word of mouth. And I had read a book by Pete Axton called The City Game, and he had just hinted at the what was going on in Harlem and in other playgrounds around New York. And so for Sports Illustrated, I wrote a story in 1973 about players who came back to their playgrounds, to their local high schools or whatever, who were college stars. And there are four of them from the New York area. And the most intriguing one, Brian Winters was one. John Shumate from Notre Dame was one. Yeah. Dennis Duval from Syracuse. But this crazy guy named Fly Williams from Austin Peay University went back to Brooklyn. And this guy was the real deal. And I knew I'd found something unbelievable with anybody named Fly. And he was just
or helicopter, for that matter, think. Right?
Oh, my God. Anyway, so there I am. That was 1973, and somebody read the story I wrote, and in 1974, that a publisher, a very small publisher in New York, said, "How would you like to expand this into a book?" And I sent that contract back so fast, I didn't read it, nothing. I thought, this is what I want to do.
Yeah.
Maybe I can become a writer, and also, man, I'm going to go and play basketball, watch basketball. Not that I was anywhere nearly as, I wasn't like these guys. I was a high school basketball player. That's it. So I watched, I observed, I took notes, I took photos until my camera got stolen, which I was pretty sure it would. And that was it, man. An entire summer. I slept on a guy's floor in Brooklyn in Flatbush on a sleeping bag for 5 months. A hardwood floor. He didn't have any furniture in his apartment except his own bed, nice bed. So that was it. And when I wanted to write or read the paper or something, I'd put the lid down on the toilet and sit there, because you can't sit on the floor forever. It hurts your back. And that was my summer. That was it, man. I was there like a bug on the wall. I was at playgrounds all over New York, had a team called the Subway Stars, a bunch of young degenerate kids that were, I was only 24. I didn't know what I was doing. And we had a team, man. We went around and played people all over. And we had a guy pull a gun on us in a little soda store, because one of the guys was swiping bags of potato chips. And boy, did I get mad. I mean, I was so mad at them. And we had a reunion. We had a reunion this last summer in Brooklyn, the surviving members of the Subway Stars, and they gave me a trophy. It's the most meaningful thing I've ever gotten, ever. A little glass engraved trophy, and it says, "To Coach Rick." It says, 1974 and forever, Brooklyn, the Subway Stars. And it was just, when I meet people, I tend to hang on to them and become friends.
Little things mean a lot.
They do, yeah. So, hey, Rick, would you play and coach, and then would you write later in the day? How did you balance the playing / coaching and then writing as the book developed?
Well, I played because I wanted to play. I mean, I love sports. Right. I love basketball. I loved it. But when the games were too high level, obviously I'm not going to be out there with these guys who are college All-Americans and pros and what have you. And even the city ball players who never played in the pros might be as good as anybody in college. Or in the pros. So I had these things, these composition books, just like you had in school. They're kind of bound, they're green or blue, and they have like speckled covers. And I would keep that in the back of my, we wore cut-up jeans, shorts usually, that was the attire. And I'd keep that in my back, like stuck in the waistband in the back, like a gun or something, but it wasn't. And, it'd get salt, sweat crusted or whatever. And one time the guys swiped my book from me, messing around, and they knew I was very, very serious about getting it back. After that, they always looked out for me so that nobody would steal that. And I went through three of them, and I wrote my notes on that. So somebody said some great dialogue, and I'm sitting on a park bench, which I did quite often that summer, park benches all over the place. I'd write down the dialogue right there on the spot. Yeah. Or I'd take a break from a game and go write some stuff down, or I would, you know, I would memorize bits of dialogue, and that's, you know, that's how I did it. So I still have those notebooks, and from them became the book, Heaven is the Playground.
Well, we're nearing the finish line with the great sports writer, Rick Tellender. Rick, one final question for me, and then I know Bob wants to close out talking about your new children's book of poetry. But to go back, another book that you wrote, and I know you have very strong feelings about this. You wrote the book, The 100-Yard Lie. You've written about scandals at the major college football level, SMU, University of Miami. You've written about the steroid era in baseball. Interested in your thoughts on where college sports is right now, in your opinion, and especially with the tremendous impact of the transfer portal, name, image, and likeness, and then the separate one on the likes of Clemens and Bonds. Will they ever get into the Hall of Fame, in your opinion?
Yeah, let me start with that one first, if I could. I Bonds and Clemens will not get into the Hall with the writers vote, and they may not even be qualified. I'm not sure how much longer they have. They'll probably get in with some committee down the road, but there are too many of us who felt betrayed by them. You know, Mark McGwire, Sammy Sosa, the whole steroid mess just seemed to be very personal. It was very personal to me. I just hated it. I hated every bit of it.
What do you mean by betrayed? What do you mean by that word?
Well, quite simply, and I've said this to many people about steroids. Well, you know, everybody was taking them. You know, Lance Armstrong used that defense about the Tour de France. And yes, it's true. There were a lot of players taken, a lot of players who weren't nearly as good as Bonds or Clemens, who were Hall of Famers without question if they'd never used steroids. But the thing is, never once did any of these players say, yes, I'm taking steroids. Never once did they admit to it, even after being caught, until they could no longer go on. Some of them haven't admitted yet. And why did they do this? Because two reasons. One, they knew it was against the ethics of the rules, and they were embarrassed. They knew it was wrong. So they made us talk about, for instance, McGwire and Sosa, the home run race. I mean, these guys look like circus strongmen. I knew they were on steroids. I'd written hinted at steroids back in the 60s. I mean, because it was being Dianabol was being used in the NFL. And it had come, you can trace it all the way back to the Eastern European, you know, the Soviet bloc. And before that, weightlifters, bodybuilders, York Barbell. These were the guys, the first guys to get into steroids. So then it came into all the other sports. Jose Canseco kissing his biceps. You know, we knew it was there. And I feel betrayed in that much of my writing career, I wrote about cheaters. And that would include Ben Johnson in, you know, sprints, Marion Jones.
Sure.
Tim Montgomery, another sprinter. I mean, I brought up Lance Armstrong, Tyler Hamilton, and bike racing. You know, the baseball players. Nobody seems to care that much about steroids in football, but it just leaves a dirty feel to anybody who followed it, wrote about that, and praised these people. Lance Armstrong probably being the biggest phony of all of them. So that's, I guess you would say, ours, the voters, Hall of Fame, baseball Hall of Fame, that's our punishment, I guess, or that's our tit for tat. I don't like what you did to me, so I don't feel you're worthy of the Hall, because one of the conditions is sportsmanship. Now, they'll get in later. That's the other thing. Now, as far as the first question, which was, I forgot. Yeah.
No, just the impact, tremendous impact, the transfer portal, name, image, and likeness, how it's reshaped college sports.
College football, yes, and college sports particularly. Well, as we all know, at the elite level, college football and college basketball is professionalized entertainment. When you have coaches making $10, $11 million a year with buyouts of $80 or $90 million, there's nothing amateurish about this. The only people who are unpaid are the players. So the NILs, the name, image, and likeness, that's a great step forward. I think it will continue on. Obviously, the transfer portal. Since coaches could always go from one college to the other without any penalty, you got to let the players do it too. Eventually, the game will be essentially professionalized, and I don't think we'll suffer from that. There's nothing wrong with a 21-year-old man making money. What is wrong with that? I mean, what is this grandeur and splendor of being the, quote, student-athlete, which was invented by Walter Byers, by the way, the head of the NCAA for years and years. so that they wouldn't have to pay workman's compensation. So I think we're in the right, headed in the right direction. But all the scandals had to do with money. And, you know, you don't have these kind of scandals in the NFL because it's like, yeah, go ahead and make money. No big deal. What's wrong with it? You know, so anyway, I think college football is on the right track, college basketball. And yeah, there you go.
I'll turn it over to Bob to wrap it up. And Bob, I know you really want to talk about his new book.
I certainly do. If you can just give us a couple of words on that new book and how excited you are about it.
Well, it's a little bit of a departure, I guess you would say, but it's called Sweet Dreams, Poems and Paintings for the Child Abed. And it's a very retro sounding title, which is by design. It's a very retro type of book. It's 42 original poems by this particular author, me, and 42 original paintings from 42 different artists, all of whom I contacted from all over, four different countries, all different styles, but all done by hand with either oil paints, watercolors, pastels, collage, or but you know, not done by high-tech means. And the book is for kids who are sick, who are going to bed, who are taking a nap, any child that's going to bed for any reason. The poems, rather, you know, can be read and enjoyed by adults because they're not just little simple rhymes. I actually studied poetry in college. I was an English literature major. And, you know, so I used what skill I have. I won't say it's Robert Frost or, you know, E.E. Cummings. But it's, you know, I think the poems are pretty good. And each painting takes up a full page. If I already distributed almost 2,000 of them to Ronald McDonald houses, about 11 Ronald McDonald houses in Illinois, Missouri. They're going to New Orleans, Wisconsin, in Madison. I think you're going to get Milwaukee here sometime soon. As I find donors to just purchase books and just give them out to every family that stays at a Ronald McDonald house, which is where families stay when their child is having surgery or something in a nearby hospital. So, it's not even available to the public yet, but it will be one of these days very soon.
But Rick, how can our listeners donate so that more of those books are available for kids?
Well, that would be awesome. Always looking for that. And they can actually just get a hold of me. I'll give you my email address. All right. And if it gets flooded with hate mail or whatever, so be it. I got a tough skin. I'm a sports writer, but it's rftellinger at AOL.com. It's 1,000 years old. So that's it. R as in Rick, F as in my middle name, Forster, and Tellinder, T-E-L-A-N-D-E-R, rftellinger at AOL.com. They can just write to me if they're interested. Usually 100 to 200 books takes care of a Ronald McDonald House for the year, and it's not that expensive. It's a tax write-off, and you know, it's going for a good cause. So, and I'll give you a copy yourself. You can have it. So there you go.
Well, that's great.
All right. You know, every time I conduct an interview, I love to have that dynamite last question. And I've been sitting here. I can't wait to ask Rick, how does one break into sports writing? But Rick, you gave me the answer. Have the talent of Rick Tallender. There'll be publishers begging for you to write. And that's your answer.
That ain't true at all.
Thanks for being with us, Rick.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it.
Your most important shot is the one you're about to hit. And whether it's the first drive of the day, a difficult approach from a tight lie, or a bunker shot to save par, you need to know your golf ball will perform exactly the way you need it to. Superior performance on every type of shot. It's why the majority of the world's best players choose the Pro V1 or Pro V1X, and why you should too.
Hey, Bob, how good is Rick Tallender? I mean, I loved him on the Sports Writers on TV way back when. He continues to be a big-time writing force. And I love this the children's book that he's putting out for the Ronald McDonald House. It's an all-around terrific guy and a hell of a writer.
Anybody that gets exposed to Rick Tallender is going to be a fan of Rick Tellender. I didn't want that interview to end.
Yeah.
I mean, I really didn't. I was enjoying what he had to say, a wealth of knowledge and a nice, smooth, gentle way of getting it to come out of his mouth.
Yeah, that's the truth. We thank Rick Tellender, and we encourage anyone of our listeners who wants to donate so that more children at Ronald McDonald Houses throughout the country can enjoy his new book, Sweet Dreams. Next week, equally excited to welcome John Wertheim, who's the executive editor of Sports Illustrated and a regular contributor to 60 Minutes. John did a piece a couple months ago on Deion Sanders, which gave a view of what could be, and it came true that Deion would leave a historically black college and go to work at the University of Colorado. So excited to hear from John next week. For my good friend Bob Bupka, thanks to all of you for listening. Happy New Year. Kelly Elbin signing off for our first show of 2023, Musings on Sports.